Welcome, everyone, to episode 88 of the Instructional Leadership Show. I'm your host, Justin Bader, and this episode is entirely focused on evidence-driven artifact protocols. I'm your host, Justin Bader, and in this training, we're going to adopt a philosophy that you've probably heard me use and reference many times before that I call evidence-driven. And it's the idea that we will do the best in terms of our professional discussions and conversations and in terms of the decisions that we need to make as professionals if we start with evidence, and if we center our conversations around evidence. And yet those conversations often need some help getting off the ground and need a bit of a skeleton, a structure to organize them and send them in a productive direction. So today we are going to expand on that philosophy a bit, specifically when it comes to looking at some different types of artifacts. But some of the core elements of that philosophy I think are worth reviewing, and you'll find these in the core modules of the Virtual Instructional Leadership Challenge as well. First, the evidence-driven philosophy is about the idea that teaching and leadership are largely about decision-making. Those are really the heart of professional practice in both teaching and instructional leadership. Second, the evidence-driven philosophy says that we make better decisions when we have better evidence. Pretty straightforward, right? And then finally, as professionals, as humans who engage in sense-making, we have to talk about the evidence in order to make sense of it. It's not enough to simply look at evidence and just interpret it by ourselves. The social aspect of talking about the evidence with our colleagues is really crucial to truly understanding what we're looking at. So conversation, as you've seen throughout the Virtual Instructional Leadership Challenge, is really at the heart of improvement for both teachers and leaders. And in a typical year, most of what teachers and leaders talk about together, especially in those one-on-one conferences about the individual teacher's practice, would be direct observations, right? In most cases, direct observation from the administrator getting into the classroom or the instructional leader, whether that's a coach or someone else, getting into the classroom and observing, that is the evidence. But when we have virtual learning going on, when we're not able to physically get into classrooms for various reasons, we've got to be willing to look elsewhere for our sources of evidence. So we're going to go deep on that idea today. And we're not going to simply try to substitute face-to-face observation with video, right? Video can be part of the solution. Video can be very helpful. And when you are going into classrooms in person, video can be a great value add. But I think we need to be careful about just assuming you can do Zoom or do a video version of everything you would have done in person and call it good. I think we have to look a little bit more broadly for good sources of evidence, because virtual observations, to me, are just not a true substitute, right? It's just not the same as being in the classroom. And the nature of teacher practice in a virtual environment is quite different. It is not just the same thing, but on video rather than in person. So that's why we're looking at different forms of evidence. And with all of those forms of evidence, our goal is to see the whole iceberg. And we'll talk about two different sets of facts that we can get insight into in terms of seeing that whole iceberg, both in terms of teacher practice and in terms of student thinking and student learning. But we know when we observe, when we gather evidence, what we're seeing is not the whole picture. It's just the tip of the iceberg, because by its very nature, a lot of student thinking and teacher practice are not observable to us. They're hidden beneath the surface. And it's through conversation that we can reveal exactly what it is that's beneath the surface. So in this session, we're going to look at five different types of evidence, five different forms that reveal evidence of different things. And the first, we'll talk about several different protocols for this. The first is evidence of best practice, which of course we call research. So we're going to look at some protocols for discussing evidence from research, which serves as evidence of best practice. Then we will look at both observation and conversation together as evidence of teacher practice and teacher thinking. Then we'll have some protocols for looking at student work and student assessment results to get insight into student thinking and into student learning overall as we evaluate what students have learned. So let's jump right in and start by talking about evidence of best practice, which again we call research. And we have a high opinion of research in our profession, but often we don't spend a lot of time engaging directly with research. We allow ourselves as practitioners to kind of rely on a game of telephone that gets us some information about what best practice is, that gets us some information about what the research says, but it's often secondhand or third hand, or it's been translated through so many, you know, blog posts and emails, and somebody told me, and I saw a presentation on it from somebody else who read a blog post. And often we can get very far removed from the actual research. And yet we don't want to always just read primary research. That may not be as helpful as we might think. So let's look at the three forms of education research: primary, secondary, and tertiary. Of course, if you're reading an actual peer-reviewed journal article, I've got one on my desk that I'm planning to read pretty soon here that I printed out from a researcher that I always enjoy reading, you know, you're absolutely going to benefit from reading peer-reviewed published research from time to time. So that would be a primary source. If it is peer-reviewed, if it's published in a journal, if it's a little bit difficult to get a hold of, you know, you can't buy it on Amazon, you have to find a way to download that article, maybe with a university account or something like that. And of course, some of these are available free. But for the most part, primary sources are peer-reviewed, published in real journals, professional research reports. Secondary sources tend to be a little bit easier for us to access without those university library logins, and that would be things like, you know, Ed Leadership articles, Phi Delta Kappan articles, you know, anything that's in a magazine that you as an educator might subscribe to, or in a book that you might be able to easily obtain, or maybe your district bought you a book, or maybe you got a book at a conference. Those secondary sources typically are where we get the best guidance on what we can be doing differently, because they're written for us as practitioners, often by the same people who are doing that primary research, or at least by people who are kind of in that world, but also work with people who actually work in schools, right? So the secondary sources are often our best bet, and they have the most information specifically written for us. And then tertiary sources can also be incredibly useful. And we're gonna talk about those first, and a protocol for reviewing tertiary sources as kind of an entry point. So what is a tertiary source? Let's talk about that first, since it may not be a familiar concept to a lot of people. Two tertiary sources that I highly recommend are The Main Idea, which is a subscription service that summarizes one new book every month for school leaders. Jen David Lang is the author of The Main Idea, and she summarized my book several years ago, and I was delighted to see that. And The Marshall Memo by Kim Marshall, who has been publishing for many, many years. Every week he writes a summary of the most important news in education, and as well as the peer-reviewed research. So it's a tertiary source. There's no original research or discovery going on here, but both Kim and Jen serve as kind of our designated readers on behalf of the profession. And I think there are probably others out there, but these are especially high quality sources. And at the Principal Center, we actually subscribe on your behalf to the Marshall Memo and send you the Marshall Memo as part of your member updates each week, because it's so important to stay on top of the latest research and news. And yet that's such a big job. Like, who has time for it, right? Well, Kim Marshall does. He spends at least two full days a week reading and summarizing that research for you. And of course, Jen David Lang has her summaries that she sends out to her subscribers. And they've actually collaborated on two books called The Best of the Marshall Memo, Book 1 and Book 2, that go back through their archives of years and years of summaries and bring out the best research that's out there. So you don't have to read every single book, but I do recommend that you pay attention to those tertiary sources that can kind of keep you up to speed on the most important big ideas in our field. It's just a very time efficient way, but it's just a starting point, right? It's not really enough to help you implement everything you're going to read about in those tertiary sources. So we have to look a little bit deeper. And of course, we have tons and tons of books written for us, for ourselves as practitioners, for teachers, for leaders, for university faculty. You know, there are tons and tons of secondary sources that are written either by researchers or by consultants who work directly with schools. And in some cases, you know, some of us are both. Some people have a foot in each world. And those books typically are written to specifically connect research to practice, right? To guide us to implement some of the findings of research in our own specific context. So of course, this is what we do in a lot of professional development, right? Is we implement what we learn about in secondary sources, in books. And of course, if you listen to podcasts like Principal Center Radio mostly are about secondary sources, like published books written by people like me, written by authors, written by university-based researchers, and so forth. But there's a deeper and kind of more fundamental layer of research, of course, and that is primary sources. And again, these tend to be a little bit more opaque to read and a little bit harder to get a hold of. You know, often you have to buy a PDF download of a peer-reviewed study. Sometimes you can find them online. But this is primarily written for researchers, right? The challenge with primary sources is they're not really written for us. They're designed to make arguments or to answer specific narrow questions before an audience of researchers, and that's the peers that are going to peer review it. And often their questions are different than ours, right? They're asking very specific and often very technical questions to add to the literature, to add to the knowledge base in a particular, subcomponent or subdomain of the education field. And if we're not careful reading those, we can draw conclusions that are too broad from them, right? If a paper is designed to answer a very narrow question, and we want to know, well, what do I do in my school tomorrow? We may be asking much broader questions than an individual paper is equipped to really address. So we just have to be mindful of that breadth issue. Primary source is designed to go very deep on a very, very narrow question. And we just have to keep that in mind. We all should be literate in reading those papers. You know, we should have some experience with that, especially if you're going to go, into the field of research or write about, maybe if you're going to write a secondary source, you should be reading a lot of primary sources. But we have to be careful. You know, we can't always translate a primary source directly into practice. So let's talk about some protocols for discussing each of those types of evidence. And again, we'll start with the tertiary sources like the Marshall Memo. So if you're reading a summary of a book or a summary of a research paper, it's just, maybe one or two pages, it's pretty brief. It's the kind of thing you could do in a PLC meeting or a team meeting or a faculty meeting and really still have time for discussion, right? You're probably not going to read a 50-page primary research report and then have time for anything else. But, tertiary source, you can read and discuss pretty quickly here. So here's a protocol that you might choose to use. First, the summary question. What is the main argument that this piece makes? What's it about? And again, Kim Marshall is great at summarizing a longer source in his tertiary publication, The Marshall Memo. Second question, what were the most notable quotes from the piece? What really stood out to you? If you can have everybody go around the table or go around the Zoom meeting and share their favorite quotes. Often, it's better to do this without any commentary and just read the quote. If someone else already took your quote, maybe you can find another one. And you don't have to add anything. You don't have to explain or elaborate. You can just share your favorite quote. Third, questions. What do you want to know more about? Or what questions does this piece leave you with? Because again, a tertiary source is just a starting point, right? It's an invitation into further inquiry. You may need to read the whole book that's being referenced or that there's an excerpt from. So what questions do you have for going deeper with that topic? And then finally, implications. What does this mean for our immediate practice? And what actions should we take next? And again, the next action may not be to implement, it may be to learn more. It may be to order the book and read it. It may be to go to a workshop and get some training. But often with those tertiary sources, we're not quite ready to take action. We need to learn more. And that brings us, of course, to the secondary sources. So here is a protocol for discussing secondary sources like magazine articles, journal articles, books. If you're doing a book study, you can use these questions. And you could, of course, use these chapter by chapter or for something overall, like for an entire article or an entire book. The first question is summary. What is the main practice that this piece is about? What practice are we talking about? Just summarize that briefly and, have people go around and give their own summaries. Second, what is the model? How does this practice work? According to this author who's put this together, either an article or a book, what's the model that they're describing? And what are the steps and the key elements to make it work? Okay, if we want to get clear on what we're being advised to do and how that actually works. Third, what are some of the major pitfalls? How might we get this wrong? What do we need to be careful about if we're going to implement this? Because we don't want to just do something related to the practice that we're reading about. We want to actually get it right with some fidelity. So we have to be on the alert for pitfalls. And then finally, implications. What does this mean for our immediate practice, and what actions should we take next? All questions you can ask yourself when reviewing secondary sources like books. And again, if it's a longer book, you might want to go chapter by chapter to use that particular protocol. And then if you are using primary sources, if you're going to read an original peer-reviewed study or research paper, you want to be mindful that that is designed to answer very narrow and specific questions. It's not designed to be, you know, the beginner's guide to whatever, right? It's designed to answer very technical and specific questions. So the first question on our protocol is the focus question. What specific questions was this study designed to answer? What did the researchers focus on in putting this together? Second, what were the conclusions? And often those are in the abstract, right? They'll tell you right up front what their conclusions were. But what do we learn from the study? What does this tell us or not tell us? And then that brings us to the third question. What were some of the non-conclusions that we might want to take away from this study, but we actually can't because it wasn't designed to answer them? What related questions do we have that we want to go investigate next, but that were beyond the scope of this study? This, again, is where we have to be very careful as practitioners, because one particular paper or study was not designed to answer all of the questions that we as practitioners will have. So we will need to look elsewhere. Another consideration that we'll have to keep in mind is context, that the study was done in a certain time and place under certain conditions, and our context may be different from the study's circumstances in meaningful ways. So we need to be aware of that, aware of those similarities and differences, so that we know what to expect and, you know, perhaps what difficulties to anticipate in implementing anything we take away from that primary source. And then finally, the implications. What does this mean for our practice? What actions should we take next? So those are some protocols for discussing primary, secondary, and tertiary forms of evidence about best practice. We need to examine the evidence. We need to discuss the evidence about what really works in education. And there's no better place to look than the research itself. So I wanted to include those protocols first so we didn't skip that step. For the most part, I'm assuming that when we're talking about practice, we want to actually look at practice. So we'll get now into our observation and conversation protocols. And I'm lumping these together. And you're going to see some familiar questions here, because I believe that it makes no sense to separate evidence of teacher practice from evidence of teacher thinking, right? A lot of teacher practice is not just behavior or speech or actions or movement or moves or techniques. It's actually thinking. So these are deeply linked. And we really can only see practice by observing and understand practice by talking about it. Like, neither one is sufficient by itself. So I'm lumping these two together here for observation and conversation. I firmly believe that if we want to understand a teacher's thinking, we've got to talk, right? It is not enough to simply observe and treat what we saw like, you know, like we're a video camera and we saw the truth and the whole truth, and that's all there really is to think about. I believe there's always more going on beneath the surface in a teacher's practice, and we've got to talk about it to really get at it. So you have probably seen my 10 questions for better feedback on teaching. And if you've had experience with those questions, you might have noticed that none of them are why questions, even though often what we want to know is, why did you do that? If you observe in a teacher's classroom or watch a video clip from a teacher's lesson that they've provided to you, you may want to ask, why did you do this? Why did you do that? Help me understand the decisions you made. Because again, decision-making is the point of a lot of this. But I found that often asking, why did you do something, doesn't give you the answer you want. Instead, it makes the teacher defensive. And what you get from someone who's feeling on the defensive is you get a justification. You get a self-defensive explanation of why they did what they did, not really the insightful reasoning or explanation for why they did that. So instead of asking why, if you want to know why, ask how. And what you'll see in the 10 questions for evidence-based feedback on teaching is that they're largely how questions designed to get the teacher talking. Now, the word how I don't think is in all of them, but this idea here is that if we get people talking about how and the rationale and the mechanism for what they were doing, we'll get the insight we're looking for into the why. So let's look at those very quickly, and I'll give you the download link if you don't have these handy. The first is the context question. How does what I just saw, the evidence that I've just gathered by being here or observing the video clip, how does that fit within this lesson or unit? And again, the how question there will give you insight into the why behind the teacher's decisions. Second, the perception question. Here's what I saw. What were you thinking was happening at that time? Or like, how does that compare with what you were thinking? Third, the interpretation question. At one point in the lesson, it seemed like such and such was taking place. And again, the brackets there are where you put in the evidence, and then you ask the other person for their take. What was your take on that situation? Number four, decision. Tell me about a time, or what went into this particular decision that I observed. Number five, the comparison question. I noticed that students experienced blank or did blank at this point in the lesson. How did that compare with what you had expected to happen when you planned the lesson? Number six, the antecedent question. What happened before this, maybe in an earlier lesson, before this particular piece of evidence that I am sharing with you? Number seven, the adjustment question. I saw that blank. What did you think of that, and what do you plan to do tomorrow? Number eight, the intuition question. I noticed that blank. How did you feel about how that went? And number nine, the alignment question. I noticed that blank. What links do you see to our instructional framework? And then finally, number 10, what effect did you think it had when you blank? So if you don't have those questions, you can download those at principalcenter.com/10Q, and you'll get a printable PDF that you can use to keep those questions in front of you. Let's talk now about some protocols for looking at student work to get evidence of student thinking. Now, sitting down together with other educators to gain insight into student thinking while you're still in the middle of a unit, while you're still teaching the topic and have the chance to really act on those insights from your examination of student work is a privilege that we don't always have, right? So if time is tight or if we're moving on quickly, we may miss these opportunities. And if that happens a lot, we may give up on this opportunity. So I think in so many schools, we have just completely lost sight of the opportunity that we have to look at student work together. I truly believe that collaboratively examining student work is one of the most overlooked practices in our profession, often because we're looking at data instead. If we do have some collaborative time to consider student learning, we're not looking at students' work in progress. We're looking at our test scores or our assessment results, which we'll talk about in just a moment. But I want to make sure we don't skip past the power and the importance of looking at student work. It can be incredibly powerful. And I want to draw your attention to one particular type of information that we can get from looking at and discussing student work. And that's what I call instructional gaps. And of course, in every subject, those gaps go by different names, and those gaps manifest themselves in different ways, but you might call them misconceptions. Often in science, we talk about misconceptions because students have one idea of the way the world works or the way a system works, and that may be partially correct, but they may have some misunderstandings or misconceptions about how a particular thing functions. For example, the other day, my daughter was working on a poster presentation about the moon and the phases of the moon. And I said, oh yeah, it's because of the shadow of the earth. And then after a moment, I said, no, wait a minute, that's an eclipse. That's not related to this. So there are lots of places where in science, we can get misconceptions about the way the world works. And those are critically important for good science instruction, to really get a sense of what misconceptions students are struggling with. And of course, we have misconceptions in math as well, but we also have computational errors and just mistakes that students can make. And instructionally, we want to close those gaps, whether they're misconceptions or errors, by understanding where students are going wrong in either their thinking or their problem solving, and help them become more proficient at solving that kind of problem or more informed in understanding the phenomenon. Sometimes the instructional gap is not a misconception so much as it is a skill deficit, right? So if you are a PE teacher teaching students how to play a particular sport. You know, you want students to actually be able to make a free throw, not just not have misconceptions about free throws. You know, there's an actual performance element that you want them to get correct. There's also the skill issue in terms of things like writing, right? We want our students to be good writers. We want them to do good work that is of high quality. And if the skill is not there, we want to build that skill. That's an important type of instructional gap. And of course, there are other types of opportunities to improve that we might see if it's some sort of performance or some sort of ability to demonstrate learning in some way. Those are going to look like lots of different things and lots of different subjects. And anytime we're looking at student work, we can mine that work for insights about what gaps we need to close and how we might go about closing them. So here is a simple protocol for looking at a piece of student work. Again, not really a test. We're not thinking summatively here, but some work in progress or some work from the beginning or middle of a unit where students are still learning. They're still going to have more instruction on that particular topic. So the first question, what instructional gaps that have already been closed are evident in this work? In other words, what does the student already understand? What are they already doing well? And that can help us distinguish between things that we do need to spend time on and things that we no longer need to spend time on. Second, what remaining gaps are evident in this work, right? What do we need to close for the student? What do we need to teach, or what skills do we need to help them build? Third, what does this particular piece of student work reveal about the nature of the remaining gaps? Now, here's where the richness of student work is really valuable, above and beyond what we can learn from simple assessments, right? Like a multiple choice quiz can tell you what students are able to do and what they're not able to do, but it can't always tell you why. And if you look at student work, if you look at the work shown, the student has solved a problem and you can see right where they made the mistake, then you learn about the nature of the teaching that you need to do to close that gap. So that's the final question. What next steps does this suggest for for our teaching or for the student to improve in that particular area? So we can ask those questions of ourselves and each other when looking at a lot of different types of student work. You might look at practice problems. And I was a science teacher, and I remember doing my student teaching in chemistry, high school chemistry. And there are a lot of problems that you have to solve in chemistry with stoichiometry and balancing equations and things like that. If you're a math teacher, obviously, you've got to get your students to solve problems and sometimes look at their work that they've shown to figure out where their gaps are. If you are an English teacher or a history teacher, you might have students turn in drafts of their writing assignments and look at those together as a team and say, what are the gaps here? Are there factual misconceptions with regard to this historical event? Do we have some skill gaps in terms of the student's ability to make inferences or to write a clear argument and support it with evidence? If you are trying to identify misconceptions in terms of students' thinking in science, you might ask them to either explain something in writing or develop an explanatory model. Those can be useful in history and social studies as well, to really sketch out how does this work and explain it on paper. And those can be incredibly rich for figuring out what you need to do next in your teaching based on where a student's understanding currently is. And of course, a quick way to do that is exit tickets, right? If you ask students to answer a question briefly in their own words before they leave for the day, that can give you quick and actionable information. So again, this type of protocol that we just looked at is for collaborative examination of student work while the learning is still in progress. If we want to look at more final assessment results and gauge the learning that took place at the end of instruction or near the end of instruction when we are about to move on, or as a pre-assessment when we're about to begin a new unit, then of course we need to look at assessments, and it can be very powerful to look at those assessments together, whether those are tests or quizzes or some sort of standardized test, maybe that's administered periodically and then you just get data from it. If you don't actually get to look at the student work, you might want to use this set of protocols rather than the last set. So looking at an assessment, you may want to consider these four questions. First is the mastery question. Based on this data, to what extent did students master this content overall? So looking at the big trends, the whole class or all of the students, to what extent did they master this content? But then we want to break that down with couple of specific questions, like the disaggregation question: which groups of students did well, which groups still have substantial instructional gaps, and what can we do to close those gaps for those particular students? We have to be really careful when we don't disaggregate our data that we're not allowing high performance by one group of students to mask low performance by another group of students just because it all averages out and looks okay. We need to really pay attention to those groups that are really struggling and make sure we're meeting their needs. Third, the reteaching question: which specific instructional gaps might need to be addressed with the whole class? You know, if we're pretty close to the end of the unit, but students have some real big misconceptions that they really need to get corrected before we move on to the next unit, then we may actually need to do some reteaching. We do that especially in math, right? Because math builds from one skill to the next. And then finally, the implications. What does this mean for us who will be teaching it next year? How might we teach it differently next time around? So we might just be looking back for the following year, or there may be some implications for the upcoming unit. So I hope these protocols have been food for thought. I hope they're helpful to you and the teachers that you work with in discussing different forms of evidence when it may not be possible to get into classrooms in person. And again, video can be part of the solution. You know, anything you can do face-to-face, you can do not quite as well with video. But I want to challenge you to be open to other forms of evidence and to using these protocols to discuss those other forms of evidence, because video is not the whole story. So a couple of parting thoughts for you. First, I hope that these protocols are just a starting point. I hope that you will use them, give them a try, let me know what you think. But I hope that you'll also develop your own protocols. And perhaps you've had training on different protocols. Perhaps you've been to professional development. I had quite a bit of professional development as a teacher on different study group protocols and protocols for PLCs and looking at student work. And I encourage you to make these your own, right? You might find that you have been using a protocol that's just too long, or it asks questions that don't really give you good insight. Streamline the protocols that you're using so that they get you quickly to interesting discussions that lead to great insights. And if there's always a question that you ask and it's kind of like nobody really has anything to say about that, give yourself permission to cut those questions out. So I've purposely kept these protocols short so that they are only talking about really core issues. Add a question if you need to, but if it's not giving you great insights and if it's not leading to great discussion, you might just cut that out and really try to focus on what's going to be the highest yield discussion question. And then finally, the goal here of all of this is to focus our attention on evidence that will help us make better decisions, both as teachers in the classroom trying to help our students master the essential content and skills and, you know, just be effective with our students, and as instructional leaders who are making all kinds of decisions about improvement, both with individual teachers and school-wide decisions about how we can help our staff grow and get better results for our students. So that is it for the evidence-driven artifact protocols. I'm Justin Bader, and I want to thank you for investing your time in going through this training. Take care.